Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey, welcome to the 143rd episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Michelle Love Santoro, Brian, Donald Evans, and Andres Billiald. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we're catching up and also answering a ton of listener questions. It's been a while, so we've got all sorts of interesting insight about moving to Los Angeles, what value your YouTube career brings to your professional filmmaking career, what neighborhoods are cool.
And also kind of backing into having experience.
Yeah, what sort of experience is worthwhile in addition to directing experience? Maybe that's it. We'll find out. We haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah. But before we get into it, I'd love to wish you happy holidays, Matt.
Oh, likewise, Oren.
This year, the Jewish holidays and the Christian holidays span the entire month of December.
Sure, that's true.
So it's a more evergreen topic than usual.
Yeah, that's nice, right?
Well, I did actually want to talk to you about the holidays for a second, because part of what we do in December here is like we go to a lot of production companies' holiday parties, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
What is your policy on like giving gifts to people?
Yeah, that's interesting. So my wife, who started when she was pretty young acting, is like very good about like giving good holiday gifts. So like she's really good about agent, manager, lawyer. And so we have like a spreadsheet of the people that we have to give gifts for. It's tricky because that you want to give a gift that the entire office can participate in. I'm big on like a basket of cookies is a favorite of mine because like it's for everyone, but like the execs are getting a ton of presents anyway. And it's really like the office coordinator is stoked on those cookies. So you want to like make sure that it's something that's shareable, but also you don't want to get lost in the
bottles of wine.
Yeah, exactly. Bottles of wine or like a nice whiskey. If you get a nice whiskey for your agent, you might as well have not gotten anything. You could be like, hey man, do you love my whiskey? And they'd be like, oh, thank you so much. How'd you know my brand?
Right. But they got like 50 of them.
Because they got 50 of them. Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird. The other day, so my wife is an actress too. I think for actors, it's like almost an excuse to go into the office to remind them like, hey,
not almost, it literally is. Yeah, right? For sure.
And Kara's really, really conscious of not giving the same gift that everyone else gives. So like 1 year, she made her own baskets with like avocados from our tree and like some random.
Ooh, that's good.
Things that she had just baked these like really good muffins or something.
Getting good avocados this time of year is hard.
Yeah, it was a one-time thing because we have not had good avocados since that year.
Yeah, but I was going to say, if you were holding out avocados on me,
I would even be pretty mad started. About
it. I'd be really mad.
Yeah. Well, Kara's new idea, which I thought was interesting, is like figuring out who's in the office and then going and buying like cold-pressed juice for all of them for like right now.
Yes.
You know, not like put this in your pile of gifts. It's like, hey, I'm bringing you a juice right now.
Yeah, yeah. So you, we did do that. We did pressed. This is a very LA thing, but like you, especially like when people are trying to stay healthy, they're like inundated with sweets, like showing up with something that is a luxury item. These juices are,
they're like $12 or something.
Well, no, they're not, but they're like $7.
I don't know. Moon juice.
It's a real, like cash suck for sure. So like showing up with a bunch of fancy juices for people is a really thing, like a thing that people respond to.
And it's a guilt-free drink.
I mean, they think there's a ton of sugar in that stuff. Yeah. You're not drinking a soda, but you know, but the point is that like people have a lot of positive associations with it. It's a very generous gift, but it's not totally breaking the bank. Press doesn't do like a any sort of delivery service or a gift basket. So you kind of have to like go in and hand pick it, and then we'll do like a Postmates or an Uber Eats or something over to the office.
Oh, or bring it in.
Or bring it in. There you go.
So what's funny is I was talking to my wife about my lawyer, who is awesome, but I have not really done much with him this year because, you know, I just either went through my manager or myself or whatever. And I was like, well, we haven't really done anything this year. Should I get him a gift? And Kara's like, those two things literally have nothing to do with each other.
Right.
And I was like, okay, I guess that makes sense.
Especially because you really like him. Well, and that's the point. It's like, hey, remember, like, I appreciate you. Like, that's the whole point.
Even though we didn't make money for each other this year.
Right. But that's okay.
Anyway, reps. You don't need them, guys.
Boy, Larry.
They're just a gift suck.
Larry gave me a boutique chocolate bar and coffee bean, like whole coffee bean kit. It was like 12 different coffee and chocolate pairings. And that's the best.
Sounds pretty good.
That's like a grand slam for me.
Yeah.
So it's like very hard to think of something that would be anywhere near as thoughtful and good.
I just buy the new iPhone X Max for everyone, because you know no one bought that one. Everyone bought the iPhone 10, and then new one came out, no one bought it. I'm just buying one of those for each person I know.
There you go. Cool. Life is good.
Hey, who wants to rep me? Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll stop boring the non-Hollywood people.
Well, but I think that the point is that making sure that you are staying top of mind with people and showing them that you appreciate them kind of stretches into the business as well. And I think it is important to think about all of the people that help you. Directing is a collaborative medium. And so showing people that you appreciate them, whether that's a cold pressed juice or just like a text message, you know, I think is important to think about.
Right. And now that I think about it,
Oren.
A lot of our listeners, even the ones not based in LA, have their own production companies and have clients and agents. Yeah. You know, you go to Sawhorse, like our friend's company, during the holidays, and they have like a whole room with like 50 boxes of that they're sending in at the Famous Group. Like all these companies, they're sending the clients all this stuff. And so I'm sure our listeners know about this. That's more of a business thing than like a film thing.
Well, but it's also, that's any business person does that. Yeah.
But let me ask you this. Do you think if you don't send something to someone, it looks bad? Or do you think you are sending a gift to someone because you have a good excuse to be in contact with them and show them how much you appreciate them? But like next year when they're picking between directors, they're not going to choose you because you sent them a gift.
Certainly not. There's not like, oh boy, Enlo forgot that I'm lactose intolerant, but he sent milk and cookies. Yeah, no, it's not.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's more just like good vibes, basically. Yeah, I think that there is value to being thought of nicely, basically. Like, oh, you know, sugar and fat makes people happy.
Well, happy holidays, people.
Well, on that note, if you want to show your appreciation to two podcast hosts, two editors, and a producer, why not think about our Patreon?
Oh, yeah. The whole reason we've been talking about holidays is because I want you guys to get stuff. No,
no,
not
you know
at all.
What? We've had an influx of patrons recently. I think probably because of the live show, which is really great because I think that it brings people together and creates opportunities for people. I talked to someone, Christopher Weil, who booked a previous guest, got her a job because of the podcast. Look at that. That's pretty great.
And I found an interesting cross-section of people listen to our podcast. Obviously, we primarily talk about directing and writing and creating things and shooting things, but we've had a lot of actors come to our live shows.
Sure.
And quite a few DPs I've noticed as well. And I think it's because there isn't another obvious place to meet a bunch of directors.
Sure. Yeah, that's true. So the Patreon directly influences how often we get to do these events, how well supported they are, and like has really affected the way that Vernon and I make a lot of decisions about producing the podcast. So if you have a little bit of extra money you know, $1 a month, $2 a month. There's a lot of options out there. People are being very generous. So we really appreciate it. And it is making the show better. So help us put on more shows. Help us support our editors, Chris and Jay, and keep Oren and I from spending thousands of dollars a year on this thing.
And also, one last thing, and this is something we're starting in 2019 and are very committed to, is we're going to start adding some new perks in terms of like how we interact with the patrons, because we really appreciate them, but obviously don't want to take away anything from the main show. So we have some new things in the works too. So check it out if you want. Regardless.
Yeah, the show's always going to be free. If you've got a little extra money and you want to show your support to us and help us make the show better, thanks.
Okay, so now I finally get to ask you, Matt, what have you been working on lately?
So I am prepping two things. Well, officially prepping one thing. Fingers crossed on the other thing. We'll find out in a couple days. That I think I'll talk about more about after that. But it's nice to be busy in January. That's not a thing that I normally plan on, and has me feeling really optimistic. But I also, I don't think I told you this, I submitted my short film, A Gray One, to a film festival today.
Oh, I did not know that. Did you hear that Without a Box went out of business?
I did hear that. RIP. Yeah, Without a Box, for listeners who haven't gone through the festival process yet, was one of two major film submission sites. So you would go to Without a Box or Film Freeway, which is still around, upload your film, and then like you could submit it to a ton of different film festivals.
It was the exclusive submission way to submit to Sundance.
Oh, is that right? I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I know South By and a few other festivals aren't on Film Freeway, but for the most part, most major film festivals are on it.
Right, and you know Amazon owns Without a Box.
Correct, yes.
Because I'm assuming because IMDb owned Without a Box.
Yeah, I think it was kind of something like that. But I think they kind of got out of the game. And I think also Film Freeway was getting very competitive. And it wasn't really... I'm sure there's a ton of news articles and think pieces about it. The point is, Film Freeway is great. And I'm kind of just starting that whole process.
Yeah, when I read about Without a Box going out of business and all these people leaving comments on Deadline about how it's because Film Freeway was like just way, way better, I felt like I'm so detached from the indie film festival circuit because I never even heard of Film Freeway.
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So now for 2019, I will use Film Freeway for something.
Yeah, buddy.
Maybe I'll start my own festival.
The Just Shoot It Festival.
Mm-hmm. Hey.
I mean, that would be fun. Maybe we should do, well, that could be interesting. I wonder if we could do like a listener showcase would be fun.
Yeah. It's 3 minutes or less.
Yeah, yeah. festivals are a lot of work, everyone. So shout out to all of the people that make them great. But the thing that I wanted to talk about actually is that I was at a wedding this weekend with some old film school pals. Like a friend of mine got married and... it was a really beautiful, very nerdy experience. He's into metal and board games and action movies. And his wife, kind of those are his four passions, basically. And it reminded me, because the best man speech was also his writing partner and a dear friend. It reminded me of how a thing we don't talk about that film school offers that I think is really hard to get outside of normal life is... being around people who are intensely passionate about film, but don't have the same taste as you. Like I walked into film school and had my mind made up about what was good and what wasn't good and what I think is interesting or valuable or important about film, and thought arrogantly that that was kind of the only smart way to think about film. You know, like that my taste was good and that people who didn't agree with that more or less were wrong, right? And these guys are like, diehard like Jackie Chan fans, diehard Godzilla fans, like their bachelor party we spent watching like hyper violent B movies all weekend long, and it was the best. And it reminded me of how smart and passionate and articulate those dudes were about movies that I had completely written off, and changed the way I think about action movies by far, for sure. And that's like the reason to go to college is to have your mind blown. But it's hard to find people who don't... it's easy to make friends with people who have the same taste as you. You right. know, like that's part of the way that you make friends. But being forced to be in an environment where someone challenges you in ways that aren't the same as academic taste, or like professors would tell me what is good and I would believe them. But Kevin is showing me, a vintage kung fu movie that's blowing my mind and explains to me why he loves it. And that's a special thing.
Yeah. No, that is awesome. Okay. I'll go to film school.
And they all got married. So look at that.
Yeah. So just go to film school. All weekend. Get married.
Yeah.
I asked you this question earlier, which was, what percentage of the people that you went to film school, I mean, this is obviously...
Sure. Who are still in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, what's your guesstimate based on going to this wedding?
I'd say 15, 20%.
Are still in film?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
15 to 20?
So remember, and I'm thinking of my entire student body here. Yeah, that's probably about right.
And what percentage do you think were in film 1 year after you graduated?
Like probably 50? Maybe, yeah. I went to undergrad film school. So like these are 18-year-old kids who are making a major life decision.
Right, but they're 22 or so when they finish.
Sure. But then they went to grad school or something. Do you know what I mean? Like I think they got internships, and like being a film major is fun and is as useful as like a philosophy degree or an English degree or something like that, you know? Like if you know you're not going to be an engineer, like then the world is pretty open, you know, like...
Right.
But think about how many poli-sci majors are politicians now.
Yeah, I guess that's it. Because I think of how many engineering majors are engineers, or how many law...
Sure.
Well, I guess it's how many pre-law people are lawyers and pre-med people are doctors. Right. And that's probably not that high.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think also, you know, I bet there's a degree of shame, maybe is the word I'm looking for, of like, okay, you work your butt off, you get into a top film school, you convince your parents to let you go, which is a gamble and like makes them scared and nervous for your future, and they're like, they're this bright kid who's like, you know, the apple of their eye, and you know, then they're like, oh, making movies really isn't what I thought it would be. So to change majors, I had my freshman year girlfriend changed majors midway through, and she was in production, which was like the most exclusive part, and I think it's happy now.
I mean happiness is, I don't care about that part of the equation.
That's why you're in film. Heyo.
Well, so when I first moved to LA, one of the things I did my first couple years here is I had a friend that went to AFI, which is a good school, master's program, so it's grad school. Everyone in there has industry experience before they go in there, and I was talking to someone the other day about it. So at AFI, you can be a director, a producer, cinematographer, production designer, screenwriter, right?
Yeah, that sounds
right.
Those
are, and editor. I think those are like the six. And I'm sure I'm messing this up. I didn't go to AFI myself.
Sure.
But I worked on a lot of films there, and I knew pretty much everyone in the class that year because I worked on all these different student films. And of the DPs, almost everyone I know is a DP. I mean, one of them was Rachel Morrison that shot Black Panther. Yeah, and John Gulisarian, who shoots all these things. And Brian, I mean, they're either at least camera operators or something on big shows. Or some of them, you know, became big gaffers for each other and work with each other. And then DP smaller things. I mean, they're all pretty successful on average. I'd say, like, I see their names on, like, TV shows or at the Oscars and stuff now. The production designers, there weren't that many of them, but they're all super successful. The editors, I didn't know them that well because they weren't on set, but I also remember them doing well. The producers are a little more iffy. The writers also, but the directors, like there's one from the 2 year span of people I interacted with that someone might have heard of, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that speaks to the nature of like camera department, right? Like you're fresh out of school. What do you do if you want to be a DP? You know, you start seconding or, you know, crewing in some way, and then you can work your way up, and that's totally acceptable.
But you're also in a position where people hire you and you don't have to make your own work.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, exactly.
And the directors and the producers and even the writers are right out of film school are not in a position really to be hired. So there are a few other directors I know from that year that are working directors like you and me. But there's only one that is doing anything, you know, like that has like films at Sundance and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the thing that film school doesn't prepare you for is really understanding that you don't get a job the way our parents have jobs. My mom, yeah, I think I probably said this on the show before, but my mom was a teacher and like worked at two or three schools my whole life, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a whole different generation, freelance and gig economy.
So the idea of like gigging around is terrifying to them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I guess to me, it's like the interesting thing is about film school specifically is even if you go to the best film school in the world,
mm-hmm.
you still look at the graduating classes and a few years later, like so few of them in the directing programs, at least are directing things. So I don't know. Positive thoughts.
Well, yeah, I think that it's kind of like being a lawyer a little bit. Like you're like, I'm smart and creative. Maybe I'll make movies. I love movies. And then you learn what the job is and maybe you don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah. Except, I mean, there's a bazillion lawyers and they all make a ton of money and you,
I know a lot of lawyers. Most of them don't like being lawyers.
Right. But they still can get work
sure,
being a lawyer.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, cool wedding.
Yeah. It was a really introspective wedding. Oren.
Yeah.
I've been dying to know. What have you been working on lately?
Well, so first of all, I want to preface this with the fact that one of our listeners told Matt that I hog this section of our podcast.
Shut up, Bill.
Which I never thought I did, but I'll try to go real quick.
No, you're fine. You're fine. I've said it in jest.
I've had a good month. I think what's interesting is I pitched on like seven big, what I consider like big for me, commercials mm-hmm. in a row. And I did not get the first five of those seven. And I like killed myself. Like, and it was a different reason for each one. One, you know, it's like superstar directing.
Mm-hmm.
One of them I was pitching against an Oscar nominated director.
Yeah.
And he didn't get it either. So the third person got it. You know, another one, I got the job and then they killed the job. And I just, it's kind of hard, you know, because yeah. you're really.
It's demoralizing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Getting passionate, you don't get paid 1 cent to do all this stuff, and you're actually spending money. You know, whether maybe I'm hiring a babysitter so I can go work on this, or maybe the production company I'm with is hiring someone to help me pull images or whatever. It's just like a lot of work, and it was kind of a rough couple months. I got that Disney job, but that Disney job I got without writing a treatment, which is so crazy.
Yeah,
you know, those are the killer jobs that you can get without writing a treatment, but they're so few and far between,
and also are. A lower rate, I think. Would you agree? Like on average, they're like a little less. The Disney job was pretty lucrative though, right?
Yeah, it was good. I mean, yeah. No, not really. It just depends who's hiring you and how they yeah. found you.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got one job. I had my flight to New York booked. And then they decided to change directors because one of the celebrities in the commercial mm-hmm. wanted his friend to direct it. So it just kept like happening. And I would be like, hey, you know, we want you to direct these five different things this month, you know, from different people. And I'd be like, I'm sorry, I'm like on hold for all these other jobs. And then they would all go away. Anyway, so that's why I was like pretty stoked when at the beginning of this month, I pitched on two things in a row and I did not think I was going to get either one. And I got both of them. And one of them I just shot last Friday and the next one shoots in Atlanta next week. And yeah, it's exciting to book things. So
yeah. And they both, well, I've seen one of them and it's great.
Yeah.
Which
so
nice.
The one I shot last week was fun. We shot in a front yard in South Pasadena and we had mm-hmm. like police officers close down the street and all that stuff, which even though we're not in the street, we need them because we're filming in front of the house and we had
right.
kids running around. And
there's a lot of extras in that spot too. I didn't think about it. There's like a lot of bodies.
Well, you know what's crazy? Like the original concept was these two women talking to each other in the front yard
mm-hmm.
and then they did some focus group research. If you can't tell from my voice, I'm like not a fan of focus group research because I don't think focus groups are being creative or artistic in any way. They're mm-hmm. just reacting like, oh, I don't like that rug. So all of a sudden we can't use a certain type of rug in the commercial because one person said that they didn't like it. You know, and anyway, so their research said that they wanted to see families using this product instead mm-hmm. of like one woman. So all of a sudden, they're like, let's throw... She has a young kid, and he's having a birthday party. And so now, all of a sudden, we have a birthday party. And literally, the script dialogue has not changed one word.
Yeah.
It just takes place at a birthday party now instead of a front yard. So we had to add, yeah, like...
I think it looked
Six kids and eight.
Better though, man.
Adults. Yeah.
I think that's a happy accident, thanks to that focus group.
It's cool. I mean, look, I love extras. I love adding people and I love setting something in a set, but I also like simplicity, mm-hmm. you know, and I like to get multiple takes. And this was a non-union, non-SAG commercial. So, you know, you're getting newer actors that can use more takes to nail things, you know? So there's a trade-off. I mean, I'm happy with it. I think it visually adds a lot to the commercial, but I don't think it's like necessary mm-hmm. for the story that we're telling, you know? Right. And I don't know if watching it, like I just showed it to you with no sound, so I don't know if you can even tell, but I don't know if watching it you even realize it's like a birthday party because there's no dialogue about it or anything.
Yeah.
Or if it's just a bunch of people playing, or if it's an open house, or if it's like a yard sale. Like,
I think it's like a special occasion filled with kids. I think if it were right. like, yeah, like did I clock that it said happy birthday on a banner somewhere? Maybe, maybe not, but like that's not important. Like the vibe of like family gathering, kid friendly gathering. Totally reads.
Yeah.
Did you get a bounce house?
We talked about it, but they make a lot of noise.
Oh, you didn't want one?
Well, I didn't. We had a really small yard.
Get it for the wide.
I actually, my idea for the bounce house was like, let's get a bounce house and put adults in it. And then mm-hmm. it'll look like you have six more kids, you know? Because mm-hmm. kids are just like, you have to teach in school, just all like, this stuff. You have limited hours to work with them.
Make an adult wear shorts, basically.
Yeah. No, but you don't see them because they're in the bounce house.
Sure, sure. But you'd see some lakes.
You see the
and
house
stuff.
Bouncing. Yeah. Anyway. And then I've never been in Atlanta in my life. Can you believe
it? Oh,
that?
Wait. You shot in Atlanta.
No. So that was here in Pasadena.
The next one.
And then the next one. Yeah. I'm going to Atlanta. And that one's really interesting because there's a lot of stock footage and photos mm-hmm. in it, but it's not like a docu-style or anything. So, yeah, I don't know. Have you done work where there's a lot where you use a lot of stock footage or
I have pulled like a decent amount of stock footage, and actually a gray one has a lot of stock footage.
Well, do you think so? Obviously that's your short, but when you're hired to do someone else's concept, do you think that it's the director's job to choose the stock footage?
Yes definitely. Or rather, I would insist on doing it so that they don't mess it up, because the bummer about stock footage, especially if you're looking at like drone footage or anything like that, any action footage, oftentimes it's shot at 30 or 60 FPS. Mm-hmm. And so like being choosy about it in a way that only a director would be, and maybe sometimes a creative director is in tune with that stuff, and maybe an editor is looking out, but like if you want to make sure that your thing, your spot feels cohesive, yeah, definitely I would pick it up myself. I'd ask like what libraries they have access to, because like Getty can be really great, but like there's certain rules about what's editorial versus not.
Yeah,
all that
model
stuff.
Releases. Yeah, yeah,
all that stuff.
Wait, and do you feel the same way about music?
I'm less choosy about music. Yeah.
So you've worked on things where like the editor or somebody else is choosing the music.
I don't mind. Well, I'll always note about it, like if I have a problem with it. But like if I don't have a specific thought, I give an editor the benefit of the doubt that they can like find something new and fun and make it work, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if I have like specific notes, like I never want electronic instruments. So like that means that you tend to go, like I tend to like to use a lot of funk, like bass lines and horn sections and that sort of stuff. Like sometimes I'll even go with a little ska if I can pull it off, you know?
Yeah. Brian Setzer Orchestra.
Real big fish.
Okay.
California. But yeah, like I like to go stuff that's a little more throwbacky, basically. Like if you get into synthesizers and stuff, it kind of bumps me out.
Well, one last thing I'll say about this, because I do think it's kind of interesting for our listeners. I mean, you know that most of these services, both the stock footage and the music library services, have people there that will help you find music. Like, let's say I want to do a scene. I want like a song that sounds like a Red Hot Chili Pepper song. Can you send me one? Or I'm looking for stock footage that is like a family eating something gross.
Yeah. I think producer Madeline actually really had some good luck with sound libraries and working with someone to help send them tracks recently.
Have you ever done that?
No. Though the reason I like Killer Tracks as my favorite sound library is because I think that their playlists are really well curated. And so in a lot of ways that feels like a human being has like picked a lot of tracks based off of genre or tone or style or whatever it is. And so that is always a great place to start.
Cool. Yeah. Well, it's free. If anyone is looking for music and can't seem to find it, or looking for stock footage and can't seem to find it, go to one of those sites and you can for free get help finding what you want.
Which brings us to our sponsor. No, I'm teasing.
Open sponsor spot.
Nope.
Okay. No sponsor spot. Let's get into some listener questions.
Yeah. All right. Our first question is from Paul Kim. He writes, "Hey guys, he listens to the show at a super boring desk job and we give him life." Wow, that's very nice of you to say, Paul. He knows that we've talked about moving to LA, but he's still unsure about making the leap. He's a filmmaker of about 3 years now, but before that he made YouTube sketches as a kid, if that counts.
Where does he live?
In Atlanta. Because of financial reasons and self-doubt, I didn't do as much as I could have in the film industry and haven't had the most to show for it, even though I live in Atlanta. Instead, I took menial day jobs, made my own projects, freelance a bit, and helped out on other people's projects. So his question is, should a guy like him make the leap to LA? Obviously, I haven't gotten a decent grasp on the smaller market, but I have some musician friends that are moving to LA next May, and I will have saved about $10,000 by then. I also hope to have my next short film in the festival circuit. And that's his question, basically. So I think just to break it down, so Paul has kind of two different questions I think are interesting. He hasn't totally mastered the market of Atlanta, right? He hasn't managed to like gig around there. So he doesn't have a ton of on-set experience yet, but he also has this kind of YouTube background. And so I think those are two kind of interesting things. Let's start with the crew and around question. How important do you think is it to have on-set experience before moving to Los Angeles?
I don't think it's that important. But if I was in Atlanta, I'd probably stay in Atlanta, I guess is my short answer to Paul. For a while, I would quit my job. Look, $10,000.
With the caveat that we have not lived in Atlanta, so we don't really know what the vibe is like.
Right, you know? We don't know, but we know so many people that go there to work.
Yes, however, they all work on the big fancy stuff.
Right. But we know that there's, at least at the crew level, a lot of support there.
That's true. That's true. But I guess, have you ever PA'd on a Hollywood movie? Like a big time movie? Like a Marvel sized movie?
I've been on a Marvel sized set and I've PA'd.
Sure. But did you PA on TV it? Is what I'm saying.
No, I don't think so.
Because I wonder if maybe there's a higher barrier to entry to get those entry level gigs at.
No, but there's Lifetime shoots TV shows there.
Yeah, I
guess
that's true.
It's not all Marvel movies.
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot of production out there. That's true.
But to me, Paul's real question is, should you quit your day job to go be a filmmaker? You know, whether it's in Atlanta or in LA, to me, the smaller leap seems to be like, hey, I saved up $10,000. Maybe his family's there. Maybe he can stay in a place without paying rent. And $10,000 will go probably a lot farther without having to pay for rent and all these other things in Atlanta and wet your feet there.
All his pals are moving out in May.
Some musicians, right?
Yeah. But still, a support group, you know, friends.
Yeah. See, to me...
This is crazy. I feel like we are...
Totally different?
Well, not... I feel like you're normally like, yes, move to LA. What are you thinking? Just go for it.
Look, usually... It's really hard to find. If you're in a place that's not like a traditional film town, it's hard to find other people that are serious about film.
Right. You're saying in Atlanta, there are those people.
In Atlanta, from what I hear, there's a lot of opportunities to, especially to PA, to crew, to script, to revise. I'm sure all these crew people that are working on Marvel movies, the like camera loader is like a DP during their day job or is shooting commercials or corporate stuff, you know, like... There must be smaller gigs in Atlanta because there are all these film professionals there. And, you know, I'm sure there's actors there that have like 3 weeks off, you know, and they're living there for 8 months. So if the question is like, should I take the leap? But he still hasn't taken the leap of like quitting his day job that it sounds like he does not like. Like, why not take the smaller leap first? You have you're from Atlanta. You have some support system there. Take a year in Atlanta and then say, try to save more money because 10 grand, how long can you last on 10 grand in LA? 3 months?
Yeah, probably about 3 months.
And that's like if you're not spending a ton of money.
Like living on your friend's couch or like...
Yeah, renting a room in like a six-bedroom house.
Which would be a good time. That's like, you know,
for sure. And you meet people and you go do whatever film groups or UCB or go to any coffee shop and meet other writers there and meetups and screenings. But yeah, so I guess my advice from knowing very little about Atlanta is quit your job first, spend a year in Atlanta, and then come to LA.
Yeah.
If you're into it. And maybe if you're like, I'd rather have my steady income, then maybe.
Yeah. Or maybe the half measure of like, just like shoot stuff every weekend.
Yeah. And by the way, if you have friends coming out to LA, it's great. Cause then you can be like, hey, it's Christmas break. I'm going to go to LA for 2 weeks and stay with my friends and make a music video with them and then go back to Atlanta. Like to me, the leap is about deciding for yourself that you want to be serious about this. And this is like the profession you've chosen.
Yeah.
Moving to LA tends to help with that. But if you're already in Atlanta, then you can take that half measure first before you do full leap.
I wonder if Paul maybe needs to give himself a little bit more distance from his hometown. You know what I mean? I think that, look, obviously Paul just wrote us an email, so I'm just saying that, like, hypothetically, like, as a kid, if I'd stayed in Sacramento, I don't think I would have gotten serious the way that I am serious now.
Right.
You know, and I think that some of that is like just kind of getting out of the nest. You know what I mean?
But Sacramento is not a great
film town. It is not a film town. No, that's true. My point is like sometimes people need to move away from home in order to get a fresh start. So, you know, I would keep that in mind basically. But the other question that isn't really in Paul's email, but kind of sparked the thought for me, how valuable do you think YouTube videos that you make with your friends are to your career?
I think they're valuable. Look, if you got 1 billion views, that's probably valuable in some way.
Right.
If you have 100 million subscribers, it's valuable. If you are like in this like under 10,000, you know, on either one of those numbers, I don't think it will help you like on the resume, but obviously making stuff is
great.
Exercise, finding people that are excited to make stuff with and keeping them around is great. And also learning about yourself and what you like and what you don't like and how things work. So obviously, whether you're putting it on YouTube or sending them to film festivals, what I like about YouTube is you get instant feedback.
Right.
And it's like low stakes.
Well, I guess what I'm asking really more is like, because I think obviously the practice of it is all really valuable, but I'm wondering if maybe we will see young people send us less than totally professional videos sometimes. And I guess there's that hard thing of knowing when your reel is ready to show industry professionals.
Right.
You know what I'm getting at? Like YouTube is always going to be awesome for like cutting your teeth, getting into a groove, all of that stuff. But I guess it's hard to know when your student project is professional enough, I'm saying in big, big air quotes, to be taken seriously. Do you remember, like, because you started doing, you know, internet videos and stuff. Do you remember the first time you were like, ah, this is actually good?
About my internet videos?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess I always thought they were pretty cool. I thought they were cooler when I was younger. As I got older, I started thinking they were worse and worse, but I also made short films, went to film festivals, like at the same time I was like, you know, before YouTube existed. True. So
So you were pretty serious by the time you were shooting stuff.
Well, it's not that I was serious. I really used it as like a tool for experimentation, or I'd have an idea and I'd be like, hey, I'd call my roommate over and be like, let's shoot this thing.
Right.
So
yeah.
And I was really into, you know, lighting and comedy. And so,
well, okay. Let me ask this actually, relative to your crew experience, when did you first kind of pick up a camera and start shooting your own stuff? Like how long had you been crewing before you started doing that or after?
No, I was making my own videos way before I moved back to LA.
Right. I guess that's true.
So I was doing all my own stuff, and that the first time I saw an Arri light kit was I'd put an ad on Craigslist and I was looking for a gaffer. I didn't even know what a gaffer really was, but I knew my DP asked for one. And this guy showed up with this RE5 light kit and I was like, holy cow, look at this thing.
Sure.
You can own this. Like in my mind, it was like only something like a big company would get.
Yeah.
So this is obviously a guy that did not go to film school. That kind of like blew my mind, and I vowed I'm just going to save enough money to buy these lights.
Do you still have them?
Yeah.
Can I borrow some?
Yeah. It's a SoftBank 4 kit.
Oh, nice.
Pretty useless nowadays.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true.
The 1K is pretty nice. The 650 is okay. The Chimera.
Oh, well, yeah, a little 650. Yeah.
The 150s. the peppers or whatever they call them.
I still like a pepper. Do you really not like them?
I mean, nobody ever uses them.
A little highlight, a little splash here or there. Yeah, really?
I mean, with Kinos and the LEDs, it's like they're so, you know.
Ooh la la, Oren. Yeah.
They're kind of not that helpful.
Paul, hopefully we were some value to you, but just jump in, man. Just make it happen and keep us posted.
Yeah, please let us know how it goes. Our next question comes from Brenton Geyser. He is a listener and he is based in San Francisco. And he says, I got my start in filmmaking about 14 months ago directing a short doc. Since then, I've been fortunate enough to direct a few regional TV commercials, some really great branded doc pieces, and I'm now working on my first feature-length doc. Although I'm incredibly lucky to jump straight into directing, never having time as a PA in the camera department or even producing, I feel like I'm missing a lot of the industry knowledge and understanding of the nuance of production, having very little time on set. Being 33 with a family living in the Bay Area, going backwards, so to speak, is not in the cards for me. Would love to hear any advice you have for someone who has jumped into the world of directing and skipped all the other steps. So I think this is like an awesome question.
Yeah. Yeah. And the first time for us, I don't think we've tackled this one before.
No, but I bet it's like not that uncommon that someone is like kind of good with a camera.
Without a doubt. Yeah.
They get a directing job somehow on accident.
Has good taste, knows the right people, lucked into it, nailed that first thing, and then just was on a streak from there on after.
Yeah. Repeat business.
Yeah.
But yeah, but has never been on a set and doesn't know like what a call sheet is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Oren, you go first, actually, because I think that I want to see how much we disagree on this one, actually.
I think I have these two friends, they've been on the podcast, that directed like a Lionsgate film on accident. And it was like their third or fourth film. And then they got a Sony film that was like multi-million dollar budget. And they literally emailed me and they're like, hey, Oren, how does a shot list look? Because they're asking us for one. And these guys had already done all these big movies. And the only reason I knew is because I like am a voracious reader, or was at the time, and read about like how to, you know, all the things of a director. And I might have maybe also worked on some other people's things.
You're also good at like asking people questions. Like you'd be like, hey, let me see your shot list.
Yeah. I do that. I mean, I'll be on set and I'll be like, what kind of light is that? I will only be on that set because I'm walking to the sandwich shop and they happen to be shooting on my street.
Yeah. You're not the director. You're just like a
guy. I'm not even an employee.
Yeah. You're just
I guess my answer to Brenton, which I had already emailed him actually, is that if I were him, I would try to find a job on a set that maybe is not the PA. Maybe you're not doing Firewatch, but you are the still photographer. To me, like the behind the scenes stills job is an awesome job. And by the way, Brenton has a large background in photography.
Oh, yeah, good catch.
So I checked out his website. So I think that's like a cool place where you don't really have a boss and you're not really responsible for anything except for getting some great photos. And you can ask the producer, like, hey, what do you expect from me? Do you want me to take the same photos as the main camera's getting? Do you want me... Is it more behind the scenes, docu-style? Do you want the actors looking in the camera, not looking? You know, have them kind of direct you, and then you get to kind of be on your own. So I think that's like a good job. There are a few other jobs on set. You can be an editor on other people's projects and ask to come to set. You know, he's obviously has experience making things. He knows the technical things of how to make them, but he might not know the experience or know the terminology or techniques that are kind of the standards.
Yeah. Well, and I think that is all right in a really interesting, smart way to go. I'm going to go...
Wait, can I add
one
more thing?
Yeah, finish your thought. Yeah.
And then I think he can also keep making his own things, of course, but also add to that with just studying, masterclass, directing, you know, reading books, like watching behind the scenes videos, all that stuff that, you know, is what you would get in film school.
Sure. Yeah. And for less than $100,000. Yeah. So I think all of that is really smart, especially the self-education part. I think the self-education part is maybe the thing that we agree on the most. So I'm going to play devil's advocate. I'm going to go on the other end of the seesaw here. I think there's a happy medium for everybody, but I think it's highlighting the differences in the ways that you and I came up. I didn't really crew very much. Like the way that I got to direct is by writing and producing myself. And so...
Yeah, but you know what a C-47 is. I mean, you know, like, where a boom operator should be standing, or what a whip pan is, or...
Yes, I
how
have...
to use voiceover to reform a whole scene.
Sure. I would say that writing helps you with the voiceover, like restructural things, for sure. And I don't think it's important for a director to know what a C-47 is.
Well...
Do you know what I mean? In a certain sense. I think that there's the approach of, like, you can be the sort of director who walks in and tells a DP, like, how to light this scene and where to put the camera, and it just, like, has a complete mastery of that department. And if he wasn't directing or she wasn't directing, they'd throw a camera on their shoulder and shoot it themselves. I think there's that sort of director out there. And then I think there's, you know, there's obviously a lot of other ones as well. But, like...
Well, do you think it's important to know lenses?
I didn't on Squaresville. I learned on the job. I think that being articulate with the things you are trying to evoke and the ways that you are trying to, like, the feelings you're trying to get, and, like, being as specific as you can. But there are plenty of directors. There are probably plenty of directors on our show who don't call lenses. For sure. Yeah, for sure. And that's okay. I think that there's just different styles. You know what I mean? So I think that you came up crewing on all these different projects, and so, like, and you're inquisitive. So you're like, hey, what lens is that? You know? Right. And I think that there's another person shadowing on that same set that's, like, talking to the writer about where they came up with that idea or whatever. You know? And so I don't know that it's that understanding every aspect of production is essential to each artist. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I feel like the reason Brenton is asking that question is because he wants to see how other people do the things that he's doing.
Sure. That may be. I think that maybe what he's asking is, hey, I feel a little self-conscious about not knowing what a C-47 is. Should I be? And I guess I think that everyone has to learn what sort of artist they are, and that I don't want you to ever, and anyone to ever be dismissive of another department or take it for granted or things like that. But if you realize that it's not your knack to know the ins and outs of how to light a scene or whatever, you can lean into other strengths and be less production oriented. And I think that's okay as well. And I don't think you have to have crewed in order to have good taste and a point of view, which are the most important parts of directing, I would say.
Right. But let me give you a real world example.
Sure.
Because I agree with you in theory, of course.
Sure, sure. And
Steve McQueen or someone coming from the theater that is, like, one of the best directors working out there. Right. But I bet you he knows the difference between a 25 and 100, you know, millimeter lens.
Yeah, yeah. And also, everyone, you should learn your lenses.
But I guess, let's say you're on set, you're directing
something. But you can learn that on the job, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, let's say you're directing, like, a $300,000 commercial campaign that shoots for 3 days. Pretty good budget and fun product, and you got, like, a celebrity or something. And you're looking at the shot and on the monitor or through the lens or by your eye, and you're like, oh, he seems like he's a little short relative to this lady. Like, we should make him a little taller. And then, like, the key grip says, you know, you want a half or a quarter apple. So the director that's been on a lot of sets and is experienced would say, like, let's start with the quarter or whatever. Right. And the director that you're describing is like, I don't know. I need it, you know, and it will show with their fingers how much taller, you know, they think it is. Or we'll say, I don't know. What's the difference? What are you talking about? You know?
So you're
going to get the exact same solution with both versions of directors, but one of them, the key grip is going to be like, oh, this person's green. You know, this director hasn't done it.
Yeah, they've rolled their eyes. Yeah.
And the other one's like, great, we're talking the same language. Like, I've been gripping for 17 years and you're like my boss. And you know
the difference between, for sure. Yeah, I've had plenty of crew members roll their eyes at me. And it hurts.
Well,
you are
a very pale man.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
You have not had plenty of groomers roll their eyes at you.
Don't make me relive that.
At least not recently.
Not recently. No, but like, you know, when I was newer and stuff, definitely. Or, you know, there's a polite version of that as well, of like asking a clarifying question because they have to second guess you a tiny bit.
Right. And then there's even like issues of safety, like where you're like, yeah, I just thought like you'd stand in the, you know, through the sunroof of the car as we're driving and film someone.
Sure.
And someone will be like, that's illegal and I'm not doing that for
definitely.
You. You're like, well, I did that on my last thing, you know? So
yeah, experience is always going to help for sure. But I guess what I'm saying is that don't let the person rolling their eyes at you for you not being able to articulate all of the lingo. The film sets are filled with fucking lingo and it can be so intimidating. And so not knowing the difference between a pancake and a quarter and a half, you know, is not that big a deal. Your taste is the deal. And like some people are going to be on power trips and like be insulted that you don't know the exact sizing of, you know, whatever box it is we're talking about or whatever. Don't let that bother you, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right. I will say there are two departments that I'm quite bad at. Mm-hmm. And they are wardrobe and makeup. Mm-hmm. I'd say makeup worse than wardrobe. Makeup, I have two modes. I'm not noticing it or I'm bugged by it. Right? Those are my only two versions. Mm-hmm. When I'm not noticing it, it's great. When I'm bugged by it, it's not, I mean, like there's hair flying away or it seems like there's too much makeup or some color discoloration. I'll notice that.
Sure.
But I'm not going to tell someone like what kind of mascara or color shade of lipstick or something, you know?
Right.
I can just tell them if I like it or I don't like it.
Right. And I would say that you could say that about lenses as well, or you could find a way to collaborate with them a little bit more.
Right. With wardrobe, I always say like, look, this woman is in her mid-30s. She's a young mom. She lives in Cleveland and she's this, you know, and I say to my costume designer, like, I'm going to lean on you to like help me figure out how this person mm-hmm. would dress. These are some colors I like and don't like. These are some fabrics I like and don't like. I like layers and, you know, kind of real generic, useless mm-hmm. things that I say.
Well,
but I
like
also
layers
am very open to, or very honest about my, you know, I don't know the difference between a Henley and a
crew neck.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I know. I know how to crew neck.
Sure. But yeah.
But yeah, anything, especially when it comes to women's clothing, I'm sure. Just like pretty dumb.
Well, I think that maybe you're landing on the best actionable piece of advice. There's two. One, I'm hearing collaborate, like be a good collaborator. Trust the expertise of your crew members when you're lucky enough to have them.
But also, to me, study every, if you want your, you know, key grip to respect you, then respect them. Like figure out what they're doing and what their job is and why they're there, you know?
Sure, that's true. But I would say on top of that, also part of that respect is in just not being a bullshitter, right? Like it's okay if you know that you don't know the difference between a Cartellini and an alligator clamp, don't tell them to grab a Cartellini because you heard it once or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Like that's really when they roll their eyes. That then they're not being a jerk. If you're being bossy and you're just bluffing your way through something, just be like, hey, listen, you know, like I didn't really come up through that way. And like, you know, help me out a little bit. What do you think? You know?
Sure.
And I guess, is what I'm going for. Right. And your department heads are there to help you do that stuff.
Right. And I do think if you're like a Brenton and you have like a background in photography, but you just kind of happened upon a few directing jobs, it's totally cool. When someone says like, should we raise, you know, him and like on half an apple or a quarter apple, for you to say like, honestly, like I came from a photography background. I'm not familiar with those terms. I still think there's, when you're the director, you need to validate why you're the director in a way, whether you're experienced or not experienced.
That's by having taste. That's like by like making a good thing. Like you don't have to prove anything to anybody. I mean, my favorite joke, how many first time directors does it take to screw in a light bulb?
I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah. It's my favorite.
Yeah.
So just be decisive, be thoughtful, listen to people, and collaborate.
And be honest about what you don't know.
Yeah.
But also go and try to educate yourself.
Here is the truth. There's no way I am ever going to know as much about gripping and gaffing as my key gripper gaffer. I'm never going to do it. And they're always going to know more than I am on that stuff. For sure. Always. And like, I'm okay with that. I know more about directing.
Yeah. So hopefully that was helpful, Brenton. We have one more question.
Oh, boy. All right. We've got Austin Howard.
And by the way, I want to note that Austin has the shortest question we've ever gotten. And I love it.
Thanks, Austin. Love the pod. Just listened to the guide to moving to LA app, and I'm moving soon. But I'm a stand-up comic, and I'm broke. And I was wondering if you have any recommendations or neighborhoods that might be optimal. Oren, where do you think Austin should move?
If you're broke and you're moving to LA, it's a good question.
Highland Park.
No, you have to be rich to live in Highland Park, dude.
Dude, that is not true.
Not rich, but Highland Park is not
expensive. I didn't say buy a house in Highland Park.
Okay, go to Highland Park. I mean, Boyle Heights might be a little less expensive. I don't know how Chinatown is, might be okay.
Highland Park is about to get priced out, but there are still a lot of small families and like college kids and stuff living there for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on if you're sharing a room or not too, you know.
Right. I guess Highland Park is good. I honestly think it's not super affordable. But
I will say my noise musician friend lives in Highland Park, and I sold a table to somebody who lives in Highland Park, and they were not rolling in it for sure.
Right. Rent control. They've probably been there for a while.
They just moved. They needed a table.
Okay. Well, okay. Check out Highland Park for sure. It is an awesome neighborhood.
Yeah. It's getting more expensive by the day. That is true, though.
Yeah. I think there's pockets of Glendale that might be affordable.
Glendale, there's also the question of like what vibe you're looking for. Glendale, I think, is a little more family friendly. It's like a very cute, charming community. There's a lot of families that live there. Like, the schools are good. It's like a lot of single family homes, you know?
Right. There's kind of this like, I mean, it's barely sketchy, but it's sketchy enough that maybe the rent's a little cheaper. We used to call it EWEHO. It's like East West Hollywood, which is like basically where West Hollywood hits Hollywood, like around La Brea, you know, and Sunset.
I don't know that that's affordable anymore. Yeah. I'd place bets on Highland Park over anywhere.
Because, if you're a comedian, I mean, it's a good place. And, you know, Santa Monica, West Side is not horrible for comedy either. But obviously, Santa Monica is very expensive, but there might be pockets of like Palms or something, you know?
Yeah, I think Palms is all UCLA students.
Yeah. Austin. I recommend playing the lottery.
Austin, I think North Hollywood actually is the other solid bet. It's not too far from everything. You can still get like a regular old apartment there. There's a comedy club that I call the Ha Ha Hole. Not huge into it.
North Hollywood's actually good. I mean, North Hollywood's also
a lot of bars. You know,
expensive, but
I guarantee there's a lot of open mics out there.
Yeah.
So maybe North Hollywood is my vote. But you know what, Austin? Here's the truth, man. You're gonna move out. You're gonna hang out with a roommate or two for 6 months a year. And then you're going to actually figure out where your new friends live and what your favorite club is and what sort of personality you have relative to Los Angeles neighborhoods. Yeah. So just kind of find someplace cheap, you know, and know that you're probably going to move soon. That's the real advice.
And I'm sure Austin knows this already, but do you think we have the best stand-up scene in the country? Or do you think New York beats us?
Well, it depends on what your
end goal is, or type of genre of comedy.
And end goal, and also like living standard, because Chicago is incredible, but you can make a living as a stand-up comic just kind of gigging around.
Developing material and trying to sell shows.
You're doing stand-up for free. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Trying to segue your stand-up into a Hollywood career.
So I know a handful of like Chicago stand-ups who moved out here and were like, what? But now they're all writing on TV shows, so it's fine.
Right. Well, cool. Well, we're excited that you're coming out, Austin.
Austin, get that spec ready, bro.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Thanks for writing us questions. We'd love to hear more. You can email us any questions at justshootitpod@gmail.com. For shorter questions, you can tweet at us. We're @justshootitpod.
For longer questions, you can leave us a voicemail. It's been a while. 2626-SHOOT-1. Leave us voicemail. It's real cool. It's neat to hear people's voices. You can call a couple times if you mess up. It's not a big deal. I love that voicemail.
Well, now for our final segment.
Unpaid endorsements. Okay, so my first one was inspired by my pals getting married, and also a great AV Club article about How Mandy is like an insane, crazy horror movie, and that horror movies and action movies have merged together. They recommended this movie. It's on Netflix. The Night Comes for Us. It's an insane, hyper-violent, hyper-gory action movie by Timo Tjahjahjanto. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Love Timo.
Anyway, it's the action is nonstop. It's awesome. It's kind of like I've been saying, it's like John Wick, but with machetes, mostly. It's like a lot of blunt objects, a little bit of martial arts, a ton of blood. It's super gruesome. But the thing that I love about it, beyond it just being a nonstop thrill ride, is that it does the brutal gore, but with just a couple little surprise pieces and creativity in each fight sequence that like take it over the top. So it's not just dudes like punching in cool ways, but they're always using the environment, which is always the thing that I love. So like there's one fight where they're in a meat locker and like they use the bone saw, they use the meat hooks, you know, they use a cow hoof, but brutal,
right,
but still really
fun
and fun is maybe not the right word, but like
clever.
There's a cleverness to the filmmaking on top of pretty unrelenting action.
Cool. So, and what's it called again?
The Night Comes for Us, and it's on Netflix. So don't watch it with children okay, or people who are squeamish at all, because they are bending elbows all different ways, basically from go.
Awesome.
But it's like John Wick. It's like the story's not really important. A guy has to kill 1,000 dudes.
I'm going to watch it.
Dude.
And if you haven't seen The Raid, I know it's an old movie, and the second one, they're amazing. And I think of in a similar genre.
Similar genre. Yeah, yeah.
Cool. Well, what I'm going to endorse, I really hope you haven't heard of this, Matt.
Ooh.
It's an iPhone trick that somebody, like a kind of distant cousin of mine, posted on Facebook. You know when you are like writing an email or writing a bunch of text on your iPhone, you know, sometimes you like misspelled something or it auto-corrected something. And
you need to move the cursor for some reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I guess it's the same trick. I did not realize, you know, you always kind of like try to like float your thumb above the text and kind of move it and tap it and try to like,
yeah,
like use that magnifying glass.
My fingers are too fat. This sucks.
Yeah. And it always like is like one letter off where you're inserting your text. Well, if you hold your thumb on the space bar, I mean, you know this, so I'm showing it to you for no reason.
It's still like a magic trick.
You can just press down on the space bar and move your thumb to wherever you want to put the cursor. It's like it's hard to describe.
But basically, when you push your thumb down on the space bar, your thumb becomes the trackpad on a cursor.
Yes, exactly. And you can very easily move the cursor to between any letters you want very quickly. And I wonder if you can use it to select text, because that's like another problem.
Ooh,
I always
that's
have.
Oh boy, yeah.
Nope.
Yeah, bummer. still, that's pretty close.
Yeah. But
yeah,
but it's cool. It's just type in like iPhone space bar selection trick.
Kelly and Ryan live, maybe. I'm teasing, but
sure.
Like I think that the post, I think the word got out this week, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
It's a game changer, man.
If you missed Kelly and Ryan live, then luckily you listen to this podcast.
Yeah, there you go. I wonder how big the intersection of our two audiences is.
There's probably at least one person.
Yeah. Well, let us know, everyone.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. If you have any questions, comments, unpaid endorsements, email us. Again, our email address is justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can also find us on all social media. We're at Just Shoot It Pod on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. Please follow us, subscribe us, send us a message on Twitter. I'm at Smitey Pyleg.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Unlow.
On Instagram, I'm...
Oh, there you go.
I actually don't know what I am.
You're O. Kaplan.
Am I?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I've noticed ever since our live show, people started following me on Instagram.
Yeah, your Instagram's pretty good.
How do I... Because I never use Twitter.
I think it's O. Kaplan.
Oh, yeah, O. Kaplan. Hey.
Yeah.
One of the OG O. Kaplans. I hope no one hacks my account.
Ooh, boy.
It's a seven-letter name. What OG. Are you? Are you Mr. Matt Unlow?
I'm Mr. Matt Unlow. So on Twitter, I'm at Mr. Matt Unlow. And on Instagram, I'm at Mr. Matt Unlow.
Very convenient.
Yep.
That's why I did it that way.
Cool. Well, this episode was produced by Madeline Rosewatt. It was edited by Jay McAuliffe and our webmaster, who we're going to meet finally for the first time ever because he lives in Australia and he's coming to LA, is Ewan Williams.
Unless I book this job.
Well, the royal we.
Yeah, shout out to Ewan. Thanks for your help, buddy.
And the music you're listening to right now is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Leave us an iTunes review, please.
iTunes review.
Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.